First Men in the Moon by H.G. Wells, dramatized for radio by Terry James, with Harold Bennett as Bedford and William Rushton as Cavour. This is a story with two endings. My extraordinary journey with the scientist and inventor of genius, Mr. Cavour, is already well known to readers of the Strand magazine. Long extracts were published in the March, April, and May issues of 1901. But at that time, I didn't know there would be a sequel as astonishing as was the original history. We shall come to that sequel by and by. But in the first place, for those who did not read it at the time, and as a reminder, at no extra charge to those who did, I offer the entirely factual narrative entitled The First Men in the Moon by J.H. Bedford. I first met Mr. Cavour by the purest chance. The year was 1899. The place was Lym in the county of Kent. And I was an undischarged bankrupt. I will not go into the details of my disastrous business enterprises. Suffice it to say, I was young and had a pride in my capacity for speculative brilliance. I'm still young in years, but the things that have happened to me have rubbed something of the youth from my mind. Whether they have brought any wisdom to light is a more doubtful matter. Whatever the case, the spring of 1899 found me in a rented house from which I could gaze across the flats of Romney Marsh to the sea. I gazed thither quite often. You see, I was attempting to write a play, being determined to astound the theatre-going world rather than drudge for my living as a clerk. Unfortunately, no sooner had I set to work on my scenario than local distractions set to work on me. Not only was there the beauty of the landscape beyond my window, there was also a peculiar figure who often crossed it. On the very first evening, when the sun had set and the sky was a vivid tranquillity of green and yellow, I saw him. He was the oddest little figure, short, round-bodied and thin-legged, with a jerky quality in his motion. He wore a cricket cap, an overcoat, and cycling knickerbockers and stockings. And as for the sound he made... The first time I saw and heard him, I regarded the incident simply as an annoying distraction and reverted to my manuscript. And when my concentration had been broken every evening for almost 2 weeks, curiosity swept irritation and self-discipline aside. One moment, sir.
One moment? Certainly. Or if you wish to speak to me for longer, for your moment is up, would you mind accompanying me as I return?
Not in the least.
My time for social intercourse is limited, you see.
I presume you've been taking exercise.
I have, but I come here to enjoy the sunset.
You don't?
Sir?
I've watched you for 13 nights, and not once have you looked at the sunset. Not once. You walk as if in a daze, making your noise.
I make a noise?
Yes. Zoo, 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 zoo.
I do that?
Every blessed evening.
I had no idea. My mind is much occupied. I had no notion that I was annoying anyone.
It's not a matter of annoyance, not now. But imagine yourself writing a play.
Oh, I couldn't.
Well, it's what I'm attempting to do, and it needs concentration.
Ah, of course. It's a habit, you see. Well, I must stop it. What sort of noise did you say?
Zazoo, zazoo, zazoo.
Oh, it shall cease. I am indebted to you. Good evening.
Good evening. As I watched the receding figure, gestureless and silent, I began to wish heartily that I had kept to my own business. The next 2 evenings I saw nothing of him, and yet he was very much in my mind. I even toyed with the idea of using him as a comic character in my play. The third day, as I sat on my veranda, he called upon me with a surprising request.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
I do not wish to intrude, but if I can come straight to the point, I wish to buy you out of your bungalow.
Buy me out?
You see, I don't blame you in the least, but you've destroyed the pattern of my day. I live just over there, and I've walked this way for years, years. I'm an investigator. I am engaged in scientific research, and my circumstances are abnormal, abnormal. I'm on the point of completing one of the most important demonstrations that has ever been made. It requires constant thought, constant mental ease and activity. And my evening walk was my brightest time, effervescing with new ideas, new points of view.
But why not come by still?
I should be self-conscious, worried about distracting you from writing your play instead of thinking of my own work. No, I must have the bungalow.
Well, in that case, the matter must be given serious consideration.
I'm glad you think so. My experiment, you see, is at such a critical juncture.
Is it? How very interesting. Would it be even more disruptive if I was to show curiosity in this experiment?
Not at all. I am quite willing to supply that sort of information if you are able to understand it.
I am not wholly unintelligent.
Very well. My research concerns substantial opacity.
Ah.
No doubt you are aware that most radiant energy can, in certain circumstances, be blocked.
Of course. By radiant energy, you mean...
light or heat or Rontgen rays or the electric rays, as discovered by Marconi. And then there is gravitation.
Please go on.
All these things radiate out from centres and act on bodies at a distance, whence comes the term radiant energy. Now, almost all substances are opaque to some form or other of radiant energy. Glass, for example, is transparent to light, but blocks heat completely. A solution of iodine and carbon bisulfide, on the other hand, completely blocks light, but is quite transparent to heat, and so on.
I follow you perfectly. Which is more than could be truthfully said of the next stage in his explanation. He pulled out a notebook and showed me, via what he declared to be quite elementary mathematics, how he had developed a system termed the coefficients of perviousness. Masking my lack of comprehension, I encouraged him to go on, which he happily did for nearly an hour, before suddenly looking at his watch and announcing that he must return forthwith to his workshed. You have a workshed?
Oh, yes, and three assistants who await my guidance. Please excuse me for rushing away, even though I'm grateful for your polite attention. I don't often find myself with an intelligent listener.
Well, in that case, why not make talking to me your new habit, in place of the one I spoiled?
Oh, I...
At least until we can settle about the bungalow.
I'm afraid I should bore you.
You think I'm too dull?
Oh, no, but the technicalities. Of course, it would be a great help to me. Nothing clears up one's ideas so much as explaining them.
Hitherto... My dear sir, say no more.
Then I accept your offer.
I am delighted. By the way, my name is Bedford.
And mine is Cavour.
Mr. Cavour. I look forward to our future meetings.
I do too, Mr. Bedford. Until the first of them, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Oh, I should say that I am already greatly indebted to you. You have completely cured me of that ridiculous habit of humming. Goodbye again.
At first, his offer to purchase the bungalow had awakened my keen business sense, in spite of obvious difficulties, like my not owning the place. But then I found myself engaged by his enthusiasm for this as yet unspecified project. Reading the signs, I felt that he was no mere crank playing at discoveries. Cavour came the next day, and the day after that, and delivered two lectures on physics, little of which I followed, but I clung to my conviction that he was on to something. At the earliest opportunity, I accepted an invitation to visit his house, and the sight of his equipment heightened my interest. Unfortunately, his assistants were a little less inspiring.
Gibbs here is responsible for all the woodwork. Spargus does the metalwork and the cooking. And Quaid is a general assistant.
But I don't have nothing to do with the furnaces.
No more do I.
Well, I certainly don't.
Oh, come off it, Gibbsy. You've always tended them.
Not anymore, though.
Why not?
Well, it should be Quaid's job. He used to be a gardener. No. Coal's his business.
I don't follow the connection.
Well, stuff's dug up, ain't it?
That's as may be, but coal's metallic, like ore.
Oh.
And Spargus is the metal worker.
Coal in a metal, ignorant yokel. It's fossil wood.
Well, since Gibbs is the joiner, that's why he got the job in the first place. Isn't he, Mr. Cavour?
I don't care which of you feeds the furnaces, as long as it's one of you. Come on, Bedford, come on. Let us leave them to argue it out. I want to show you the dynamos in the cellar.
Amidst the humming and buzzing machinery, it became increasingly clear that Cavour's experiment was well beyond the theoretical stage we discussed each day. Gratifyingly, he claimed that our talks had hastened the progress of all that was going on around us. But I remained puzzled when he showed me a container on an upper floor.
All the compounds are now fused. They still need a deal of continuous heating, but we shall start the cooling process in 7 days' time.
But what will be the end result? In all our conversations, you've managed to describe at length the means without ever defining the end.
I have. How very absent-minded of me. Why, the aim is to create a substance totally free of the Earth's gravitation or that of any other heavenly body. A substance that will defy the laws of Newton.
But that would be a miracle.
There's nothing miraculous about it. Merely the result of painstaking scientific research, years of it.
And at last your dedication has borne fruit?
It will, even if this particular attempt fails.
It mustn't.
Oh, I'm used to being patient.
I am not. Now that you've told me, I can hardly bear to wait out the week. But at least it gives us time to look ahead. If you will allow me to intrude on your plans, of course.
What plans?
You mean you haven't had any thoughts about what to do with this invention?
No, I merely set out to prove that it is possible.
Thank the Lord our paths crossed before it was too late.
Too late? I don't understand.
The tour of inspection was complete, and so I made Kervor come back with me to my bungalow. As we walked, I explained, for his own good, how he must go beyond the innocent limit he had set to his ambition.
Don't you see? There are no limits to the possibilities of the stuff. If you want to lift a weight, however enormous, all you have to do is to insert a sheet of your substance beneath it, and it could be moved with no effort.
This is true.
By the way, have you thought of a name for your substance?
Anti-gravity matter?
That's very modest of you. How about Coverin? Or Coverite? Coverite is better.
Need my name come into it?
Oh, yes. Just imagine. The Central Coverite Company. Controlling a veritable empire of daughter companies. Rings, trusts, privileges and concessions spreading across the globe.
I should be happy enough for simple recognition by the world of science.
Oh, naturally. But I shall make sure they don't exploit you under the guise of academic acclaim.
You definitely want to help. But what are the play you are writing?
I've forgotten it. My dear Cavill, if you want to keep me out of this, you'll have to do it with a gun. From tomorrow, I shall be your fourth labourer. And if the others are still arguing over who feeds the furnace, I shall sort them.
We had almost reached my bungalow when the commotion started. I looked back in time to see the chimneys of Cavill's house jerk heavenward. The roof and some of the furniture follow, though all were overtaken by a huge white flame. When the winds eased and I staggered to my feet, Cavour was nowhere to be seen. That is, until a mud-covered figure crawled from a ditch.
Congratulate me, Bedford! I've done it!
Congratulate you? You were expecting that explosion?
Oh, no, not so soon. And it wasn't an explosion.
Whatever it was will have put an end to your assistance, I should think.
Ah, yes, poor fellows, three martyrs to science. But did you not see the Coverite, as you wish it to be called? That blue shining square shooting off into the heavens?
That was Coverite?
Oh, definitely. Hence, there was no explosion. By my calculations, nothing should have occurred until its temperature had dropped to 60 degrees Fahrenheit. But all the same, it's clear that the air pressure above the Coverite square was negated,
causing a vacuum.
More like a fountain of weightless air rushing up a sort of chimney and sucking in more and more air from outside. It is fortunate for us all that the Coverite was loose and got dragged up the chimney itself. Otherwise,
the Earth's atmosphere would have been emptied.
Eventually.
Good Lord. And all mankind would have died of suffocation.
Regrettably. In certain circumstances, I seem not to think things through sufficiently. But I'll make sure there isn't the slightest risk next time.
It was clear there were unforeseen drawbacks to Mr. Cavour's society. While he was removing the mud from his person, I thought seriously of withdrawing from such a potentially fatal association. And yet, one hour later, the two of us were picking our way through the remains of his house. A good half of the building and its contents had vanished into space, and it seemed certain the same fate had befallen the trio of assistants, until we heard an unseemly row coming from the lane.
Good Lord.
So they weren't even here.
That would explain it, Bedford. They let the furnaces go out.
Then you can shift the blame onto them.
But they didn't know what would happen. I'd still be partly responsible. And if local damage is extensive, I cannot afford to pay for it. Gibbs! Queen! Spargus!
Oh, you're all in one piece then, sir.
Yes, I'm glad to observe the same about yourselves. We feared the worst, having left you here.
Well, sir, we decided to settle our differences at the alehouse.
And so you missed the cyclone.
Eh?
The cyclone, my dear Bedford. Only a freak of nature could have done such damage. However, we shall start again with fresh and eager determination. And what is more, Mr. Bedford is going to join us and supervise your labours.
He's what?
Believe it or not, the three scoundrels went on strike. However, after 2 days, Cavour somehow persuaded them to accept me as foreman, and the reconstruction proceeded apace. Once the workshed was in operation again, all that was left, apart from the creation of more Cavourite, was for its inventor to stun me with his vision of how it could be used. We had been enjoying a walk in a sort of silence.
That's it! That finishes it! A sort of roller blind!
Finishes what?
Space! Anywhere! The moon, if you like.
What do you mean?
Mean? Why, it must be a sphere! That's what I mean. The last batch of Cavourite was made in a flat pan. And once the roof of my house was blown out of the way, up it went.
So I remember.
Well, if it was shaped as a container, one could go up with it.
Well, if one so desired, but...
Imagine a sphere, large enough to hold 2 people and their luggage, made of steel, lined with thick glass, containing a store of solidified air, concentrated food, water distilling apparatus and so forth, and enameled, as it were, on the outer shell with Cavourite. What do you say to that, Bedford?
How'd you get inside the thing?
Perfectly easy. An airtight manhole.
You would get in and screw down the manhole while the Cavourite was still warm, and as soon as it cooled down, you'd shoot off into the air.
Yes.
Travelling in a straight line into space forever. There's no way you could get back.
But I've just thought of a way. The Cavourite part of the sphere will be made in sections, with each section capable of rolling up like a blind. When the Cavourite windows or blinds, whichever you like to call them, are all shut, the sphere will fly through space in a straight line, as you say. But imagine one of these windows open. At once, any heavy or heavenly body that chances to be in that direction will attract us. You see?
I'm beginning to.
We shall be able to tack about in space just as we wish.
But what for?
Well, as I said, one might go to the moon.
And when one got there, what would one find?
We should see... consider the new knowledge.
Is there air there?
There may be.
It's a fine idea, but...
Is there nothing in it that attracts you?
One could sell the story, I suppose.
That's right. And since you are keen on commerce, think of the minerals we might find, possibly entirely new elements.
I hadn't thought of that.
And it isn't as if we're confined to the moon. There's Mars. Clear atmosphere, novel surroundings, an exhilarating sense of lightness. It might be pleasant to go there.
If it was, then people would pay. There's something in this. One could have a whole fleet of Cavourite liners, spheres deluxe. Good Lord, I'm beginning to take it in. The control we would exercise. Like the old Spanish monopoly on American gold. We would have a monopoly on whatever was found out there. Planetary rights of preemption.
Whatever they are, I'm sure one could have them.
I've been dreaming of this sort of thing. This is tremendous, Cavour. It is positively imperial.
In January 1900, there arrived a huge packing case, our thick glass sphere. By February, all that was necessary for the steel shell and the blinds had arrived and were meticulously bolted together. At the end of March, the Cavourite paste was ready to be heated to a dull red glow in a stream of helium. When at last our provisions were gathered, our helpers paid off, and I was bricking up the furnace built round the sphere for the final stage, I fell into a bleak mood. I tackled Cavour about the pointlessness of it all. His response was that we simply had to go, and what I needed was to rest for a little while. I defiantly went on with my bricking and ensured myself a night of insomnia. A week later, on a still and clear evening, the furnace in the garden had been dismembered and the Cavourite paste covering the sphere was cooling.
Well, my dear chap, all the essentials are on board, except ourselves.
Yes. Will you go first?
If you wish.
In spite of revived misgivings, I joined Cavour in the sphere, and we screwed in the glass manhole. Cavour pressed the stud to close the blind, which covered the hatch.
So at least that blind works.
They all will. Trust me.
Cavour,
Why have we no chairs? Very uncomfortable, sitting against this curve.
We shan't need them. You will see.
Cover, my nerves are in rags. I don't think... Confound it, I'm a fool. This thing is too risky. I'm getting out.
It's too late. That little jerk we felt, that popping sound we heard, already we are flying as swiftly as a bullet up into the gulf of space.
So, we're committed.
Oh, yes, we're committed.
If only I could get comfortable.
Don't move yet. Let your muscles keep quite lax, as if you were in bed. You see, we're in a little universe of our own. Look at our luggage.
It's floating. And you seem to be as well. There's nearly a foot between you and the glass.
Feel behind you, and you will find you are in a similar state.
You knew this would happen.
It seemed likely. No gravitation can get through to us from outside.
It's the strangest sensation.
But not unpleasant.
I don't know. Perhaps I shall come to like it.
My dear fellow, of course you will.
Cavour was right. My horror of floating thus soon passed, and the sensation became exceedingly restful. I had expected a giddy sense of speed. Instead, I felt as if we were disembodied. And in this relaxed condition, it was easier to accept another long period of darkness. Our limited store of electrical power dictated such economies.
Have you any idea of our direction?
Well, given the tangent at which we are leaving the Earth, and as the moon is near her third quarter, we should be going somewhere towards her.
Would it be possible to make sure?
I'll open a blind.
But it's dazzling.
Because we have been in the dark. I'll open some more blinds to ensure our being pulled in its direction.
It's larger than I'm used to seeing it, but we still have a long way to go, do we not?
Only 200,000 miles or so.
From this angle, I feel as though we're going down towards the moon. It is peculiar to have the light coming from below.
Once we are on the moon, it will come from the sun above, as we are used to. Except that the day is as long as 14 earthly days.
Does that mean the night is as long as 14 earthly nights?
Yes, with a temperature of absolute zero.
Bit rough on the inhabitants.
Which is why there aren't any. How could there be in such conditions? Unless it was something worm-like or a thick-skinned monster.
We should have brought a gun.
No, we just have to go and see.
There is little more to say about the journey. For the most part, in a sort of quiescence that was neither waking nor slumber, we fell silently, softly, and swiftly down towards our destination. Finally, there came a day when Cavour suddenly opened six of our shutters and almost blinded me. The whole visible area was moon.
Ah! Oh, you might have given me notice. I may never see properly again.
I'm sorry. I thought you were asleep. I had been asleep and should have roused myself earlier.
Why are you suddenly in a panic?
There's a great deal to do. I'd be obliged if you would lend a hand. Firstly, we must bind blankets around our luggage to soften the impact of our descent.
We're about to land.
Yes. Take this rope, please.
Of course.
Round there.
I'm doing my best.
Need this include pressing your feet against my chest?
I didn't mean to, though I need something to take the strain if I'm going to make this knot fast.
Try the side of our vessel.
There we are.
Good.
How much time do we have left?
Very little. There are two remaining blankets. Wrap one round yourself.
If you think it will help. What about yours?
I need my arms free for the moment. That should put the brakes on a little.
But now all we can see is the sun. Have you a clear idea where we're going to land?
Of course I haven't, having not been here before. Right now I shall be content to meet with an approximately level surface. Stand by to land. Good.
After the first impact, Cavour snapped all the shutters open as quickly as possible. Indeed, it was only possible because the sphere rolled along for a little while. We were like a couple of maddened goldfish, bumping against the glass and against the big bale of our luggage and clutching at each other. Meanwhile, splashing against the outside of the sphere was a white substance, as if we were spinning down a slope of snow. Eventually, the vessel came to a halt.
Why then, we have arrived.
And are living, if a little battered. Now, if I can stand, it is time, at last, to look at the landscape of the moon. But it's tremendously dark, Cavour.
That will be because it's not yet daybreak.
The glass is getting moist. T- Damn it. The more I wipe it, the worse it gets. It's absurd. We've arrived on the moon, and all we can see is the misted-up wall of this bubble we've travelled in. And now, the moisture's freezing.
Put on the electric heater, the black knob by your left hand, or else we'll freeze too.
Well, that would be a fine irony, to come thus far and then freeze to death. Oh, confound it. At this rate, we might as well have stopped at home. What are we to do?
Wait. Now, by my reckoning, the dawn will come in about 30 minutes, by which time our air will be warm and the glass will clear. Oh, be patient, my friend.
And so, during the wait, we untied the rest of our luggage. As we did so, the glass began to clear, giving us at last a panoramic view of the lunar landscape. It was the wildest and most desolate of scenes. Drab and greyish rock lined here and there with banks and crevices of snow. We were in a vast circular plain, which was the floor of a huge crater. At the same time, we rested not far from the edge of another, smaller crater. But it was the higher reaches of the landscape which held our attention.
The sunlight is moving down those cliffs with remarkable speed. It'll be on us soon.
And on the snow around us.
If it is snow, it might be frozen air.
Whatever it is, it's starting to steam.
It must be air, or it wouldn't rise like this at the mere touch of a sunbeam.
Cover, what of the heat? It has just struck me. Now all the shutters are rolled back. The sphere could behave like a giant magnifying glass. We could fry.
This is a possibility.
Is that all you have to say?
No, I have to tell you, we have a more immediate problem.
What?
The area we have landed on is melting. But if we start to roll...
Lord, help us. Oh. We're going already towards that little crater.
Our second tumble along the moon's uneven surface was much more dangerous than the first. It was not enough that the sphere quickly gathered momentum once the landslip had set it rolling. Within the hurtling vessel, all our belongings were loose and at liberty to do their own damage. And they did their worst. The last thing I recalled was a sensation of utter sickness, a feeling as if my brain were upside down within my skull. All was darkness until somewhere distant I seemed to hear a ghostly version of Cavour's voice.
Edward. At last, a response.
What?
Bedford, my dear chap, can you hear me now?
Now? You mean, have I been insensible long?
I don't know the exact number of hours. My chronometer is broken. But, my dear fellow, I was afraid...
I'm not ready to desert you yet. Lord knows how many bruises I have, but nothing seems to be broken. Your face has been bleeding.
Is it?
You must look after yourself as well, you know.
Oh, it doesn't seem to hurt very much. In fact, now you are conscious, we haven't come off too badly. I think we can say the sphere was built to last.
How are things outside?
The air, if it is air, has evaporated, and one can see the bare earth, if it is earth. And curiously...
Curiously?
It doesn't make sense, but I noticed something very like dry, twisted sticks on the ground. Something definitely fibrous, at least.
On a lifeless planet?
Just so. Shall I help you up to see for yourself? Here we come.
Thank you.
Much pain?
Not too bad. I think my curiosity has got the better of it. Yes, I see those sticks of yours. But what about those pebbles near us? They're cracking open.
So they are. The heat must be greater than ever. This is where we rolled into a measure of shade.
Yes, but inside the pebbles there is green matter, expanding. There are shoots growing out of them.
Seeds.
Well, when did seeds grow at such a speed? There are masses of them. Popping out all over the place.
Then there must be air. Though we'd better try a test before we risk an excursion.
There was a small valve built into the sphere, through which items could be ejected without much loss of air. While the strange plants outside grew stalks and leaves at a furious rate, Cavour produced a piece of paper from the luggage. He crumpled it, set it alight, and thrust it through the valve. I peered through the glass and saw the paper drop onto the ground. At first, it appeared to go out. But then, all of a sudden, it started to burn properly, almost as it would on Earth. We followed one more precaution. Gradually, we loosened the glass manhole, but kept a cylinder of compressed oxygen at hand to restore our pressure if necessary. Finally, we clambered out, and Cavour said, in the peculiarly tinny tones created by so thin an atmosphere.
Shall we go forth?
Nothing ventured.
I'll go first.
Oh! Good Lord. My God! You've jumped 30 feet. Wait for me.
Oh, good leap, Bedford. We shall have to be careful not to overreach ourselves, but isn't it wonderful to be out of Mother Earth's leaden strings?
I'd forgotten one would feel so light.
We're at barely a sixth of our earthly weight.
If these plants continue to grow at such a rate, they'll be at shoulder height soon.
We must hope they have an inbuilt limit. There appears to be nothing else to hinder them. No insects, no birds. Really, this is no world for men, and yet, in a way, it appeals. I'm going to leap over there.
What the devil?
Look out for this species. It has a very sharp leap.
There was a truly stunning variety amongst the bushes springing up all around us. It struck me that right away we had found a source of financial gain. If we could transplant one or two, the sums we could make from horticulturalists would be vast. I shouted out this idea to Cavill and got no response. He was nowhere to be seen. I jumped in the direction I last saw him taking. Several more leaps were necessary before I almost landed on top of him.
Oh, steady on. You nearly bowled me over.
If you must hide in the bushes...
The bushes hid me. They were only up to my waist when I landed here.
I thought I'd lost you. We really must make it a rule to keep each other in view.
Of course, I'm sorry. It's this newfound athleticism. I was never much of a sportsman on earth, you know.
In spite of the cricket cap?
Oh, this old thing. I only wear it because it fits.
Oh, no.
It's the truth, I assure you.
I'm not talking about your cap. Where's the sphere? Where is the sphere? I can't see it.
I think we left it over there. I'm not sure. Anyhow, it can't be far. Can it?
All about us on the sunlit slopes, the darting shrubs frothed and swayed. For an age, we leapt from crag to plain and back again.
No sight of it from here either.
I think, after all, it might be over there.
We've just leapt back to where we were.
Where we were when?
Just now. Here's the mark of my heels.
Well, there's no sign of mine.
Oh, how can we be so foolish?
We certainly need to find the sphere soon, with its endless heat and... I'm hungry.
I'm hungry too. What in heaven's name?
Breakfast gone?
You mean we're sharing hallucinations?
In this place, who knows? Did you hear it that time?
Of course I did. I practically felt it with my feet. What could make a sound like that so deep in the earth?
Why don't we consider possible explanations when we're back in the safety of our sphere?
Oh, I'm all for that. But will we ever find it?
Of course. We'll go this way.
Still no sign.
Oh, dear. Possibly it's overgrown.
A highly cheering thought. At least that blessed booming has stopped.
What on earth?
Instead of which...
It almost sounds like an iron door, but on a huge scale.
Opening?
Probably.
So they may be coming out.
If anyone's there.
Well, the door would suggest entries and exits, would it not? Oh, of course, the door itself is only a supposition. Until we're captured and dragged through it.
Calm yourself.
In view of our situation... In spite of our situation... I'll do my best.
I'm sure you will. Now, for the moment, we had better crawl. The plants will give us good cover, and it may even be easier to spot the sphere looking between the stalks.
All right. But which way?
Well, we haven't tried that direction. Eh? Have we?
Whether we had or no, that was the direction we took. After we had crawled fruitlessly for considerable time, our ears were assailed by new sounds.
Of some variety.
Let's crawl the other way, quickly.
We shall, yes, but if there's a chance of a fleeting glimpse...
A fleeting glimpse is all it would be. Anything that can make that noise will be able to trample us to death. They must be gigantic. For heaven's sake, come on. That's the wrong direction.
You must come and see.
No.
It's safe, Bedford, I assure you. The creature is heading away from us. But it's fascinating.
I'll take your word for it.
Have you no curiosity?
Oh, damn it. Ugh. It's disgusting.
The creature was more vast than I had fearfully imagined. The girth of its trunk was some 80 feet, its length perhaps 200. And most of this bulk appeared as pulsating white-skinned fat. One passed us by, then another, and then another. The third came nearest to our hiding place, offering an unpleasantly clear view of an almost brainless head with a slobbering, omnivorous mouth which suddenly gaped to reveal a huge red pit.
The stench of its breath alone might be enough to kill us.
Don't worry. Oh, dear, it's on its way. Though for all its unpleasantness, there's something youthful about its cry. A mere moon calf.
That's a calf. I don't want to encounter one that's fully grown. Come on. Look that way. There's another creature behind them, driving them along.
This is an historic moment, Bedford. Our first view of a Selenite.
A what?
Selenite, moon man, after Selene, the moon goddess.
With those tentacles and hard casing, he looks like an insect would if it walked on its hind legs.
The leathery exterior might be clothing or armour.
Concealing a soft and gentle creature within?
We may never know now.
Once they had gone, we set off in the opposite direction, continuing our search for the sphere. At one time, we came close to another pasture littered with gross grazing moon calves, and we saw another Selenite in charge of them. He stood on a promontory of rock, which gave us a chance to study him more easily, though I was still afraid we would be discovered. He was a compact, bristling creature, perhaps 5 feet high, with whip-like tentacles and short arms which barely projected from his shiny, cylindrical body case. The form of his head was hidden by an enormous, many-spiked helmet, and when he finally moved off, he carried himself upon short legs that flimsily led down to tiny feet. After seeing him move along a mooncalf by driving his spiked headpiece into its flank, even Cavor became loath to strike up a closer acquaintance. Once more, we reverted to our increasingly desperate search.
You're lagging behind, Bedford.
I can't help it. I feel weak. I must have food.
It's a case of holding out.
I can't.
It's as bad for me.
What about this fungus we keep crawling past? It looks edible enough. Yes, it even smells all right.
Don't.
Why not?
Poison.
I'll chance it. It's a gamble between that and starvation. Just a fragment, at least.
But the risk.
Good.
Oh, Lord.
A bit like mushrooms, but easier to swallow. Will you join me?
If
please yourself.
If it should prove toxic. Oh, confound it. Pass them over.
Thank you.
Not unpleasant.
I have to admit it.
Leave some for me.
But you had a head start.
I'm bigger than you are.
I've been leaping just as far.
When we still felt free to leap. I hate this crawling.
If we hadn't crawled, we might not have spotted our breakfast. Or at lunch now.
Whatever it is. Good. Infernally good. Good old Selene, goddess of the moon, she has provided.
I wonder what the Selenites themselves eat.
They're damn fools if they ignore this stuff.
It's infernally good.
What a home this could be for our surplus population. No starvation.
Wonderful idea. All your scheme will come to fruition, Bedford.
Fail. Whoops.
What is it, my friend?
Head swimming a bit. Sudden food after fast.
You stay the same. So, good job. I found food for us.
You didn't discover food. I did.
Well done.
Thank you.
Necessary act. We are the creatures who want to eat and drink.
But we are soldiers of fortune, too. And now we must annex this moon.
Hooray.
Forward,
and no shilly-shally.
On our feet!
Eh?
No more crawling. Give up our stomachs. Must have human dignity.
Here, here.
Ah, this way, Bedford. I can see six of us insect men.
Come back before they see you.
That's not dignified. My children, who's the masters?
Of course, but six against two.
Piffling odds! Come on, man! Another historic moment! Woohoo! Hello, you insects! Here we are, my friend and I! We're not hiding anymore!
Cavalier! Cavalier!
When I regained consciousness, I was sitting in complete darkness, with a disorder of mind which made me think, first of all, that somehow I had got into the cellar of Cavour's house. Then I remembered we had finished the sphere, and fancied I must still be in it, travelling through space.
Can't we have some light? Cavour?
Oh.
What was that?
My head. Oh, my head.
Cavour, why have you chained me up?
I haven't chained you. It's the Selenites.
The Selenites? Oh, Lord, I remember now. I tried to stop you leaping towards them, but I fell over, and after that, everything's a blank.
I too fell over in a somersault right amidst them. We were both deeply intoxicated.
So we were easy game for them.
Yes. I passed out too, but not before we'd been dragged in irons down a great opening in the ground.
It was a door we heard opening then.
Almost certainly. Only it was more like a huge sliding lid.
What are we going to do?
How should I know?
You better think of something. You got us here, charging straight into their hands like that.
My mind was unhinged by the fungus you made me eat.
Without it, we might have died of hunger. Oh, do you have to?
You asked me to think. Though maybe it is too late.
A thin, bright, bluish line of light cut through whatever space we were in. I looked towards the source, which revealed itself as an opening door, and there stood a grotesque outline, silhouetted against the glare. The Selenite came forward and reached a point where the light gave us a clear and shocking view of his face. There were no ears or nose, and the thing had dull, bulging eyes at the side. The mouth was a severe downward curve, and the neck, which held up this mask-like vision, was jointed in three places. He stared at us for a while, and then shuffled out. The door closed, and we were back in pitch darkness.
I suppose he was checking that we were still alive.
You were right about them wearing armor before. That one looked like he was made of blancmange, except for his curious neck.
I suppose all those joints are to help them balance.
I wonder they don't bump into things with eyes where their ears should be.
They are definitely physically adept, all the same. The tunnel we were first taken into was no rough burrow, and we now know there are lights outside this cell.
They might have put one inside it. This darkness is beginning to unhinge my mind. We'll never get out of this mess.
Of course we will. There must be a way. If only we can establish rational communication. Or we could try geometry. One of the great basic principles, since these creatures are clearly intelligent.
You'd have to ask for pencil and paper first.
One could draw in the dirt, Bedford, in the air even. I must clear my mind, ready for their next visit.
Our jailer was in no hurry to give Cavour an opportunity to test his theory. Heaven knows how many hours we languished in that grim darkness. Though when the Selenite returned, it was not merely with the intention of staring at us. I think that gesture means we're to get up.
This is our chance, Bedford. Now then, sir, can I show you something from Euclid?
He's keener on showing us the door. Well, at least he's freeing our legs.
Four more Selenites were hovering outside the door. They were taller than our jailer and wore armor and helmets. In addition, each carried a spiked metal goad. We were ushered down a short tunnel into a cavern filled with pounding complex machinery.
This is stupendous, Bedford. I think it's a refinery. Do you see that bright liquid flowing from that tank there?
Yes.
It's molten phosphorus or some lunar equivalent. There's a channel carrying it off into the tunnel beyond.
Liquid light?
Yes.
Which could be bottled and sold.
Ha! Oh, that's right. Oh, I'm glad to see you're regaining your interest in life. Perhaps you and our hosts could barter. There must be some earthly items they lack.
The import-export possibilities. Uh-oh.
What is it?
One of our goat-carrying friends wants us to move on.
But we've hardly had a chance to take it all in. I'll try and show him we're interested in the process. Me not come just yet. Me want to look round factory.
He isn't convinced. How about your geometry idea?
Very well. If I might show you a right angle...
Oh, he
stabbed me.
It's outrageous. Look here, we're not going to stand for that. Whatever you think, we're not cattle, you know.
We'd better comply quickly all the same, or else the mob will see fit to deal with us. Oh, there must be 100 of them at least.
We're going deeper and deeper in.
How can you tell?
The drop in temperature. It's the opposite of burrowing into the earth. Here we have a network of caverns and possibly a sea at the centre. That's what we should find.
If you say so. Thank goodness we now only have our escort. The crowd back there frightened the life out of me.
We were obviously of great curiosity value.
The nerve of it. As if we were animals.
But they aren't either. When they find that we have reasonable minds, they'll want to learn about the earth.
And how will they question us? By more wounds like the one you're nursing?
That was only because I defied them.
A fine civilization.
Given that these are the lower orders here, at least they made themselves plain to us.
Oh, no doubt about that.
Meanwhile, all around there are signs of a higher intelligence. And I hope we're being taken into its presence. Just think, it is already a tremendous occasion, a meeting of two worlds. And what have we yet to see? What is below us here?
We shan't see much if the light isn't better.
It must become so. We've been following that stream of phosphorus very closely.
Well, so far.
And logically, there must be a central point at which it accumulates. I cannot help but be excited at their handling of natural resources.
Now, you better rein in your enthusiasm.
Why? Oh, no.
The glowing blue stream of phosphorus had dipped suddenly out of sight, and we were at the edge of a gulf so deep and wide that neither the bottom nor the far side were visible. A thing like a gangplank projected from the edge of the cliff and stretched out into the void. An unarmored Selenite tugged at my arm. I resolutely stayed put. He walked out onto the gangplank as steadily as if it was firm earth and beckoned.
Gosh, he can't be serious. I couldn't go 3 steps on that plank, even with my hands free to keep balance. They can't know what it is to be giddy.
What chance do we have of explaining?
We must try. Impossible for us cross bridge. No light. No handrail. We fall.
Don't push me like that. Ow! Confound you, if you stick that spike in me again...
Bedford, ow! We must try mine, or else...
Quick! My hands are loose. Pull hard at the chain, the metal's soft.
I'll try, but now you can gesture to them properly.
The only gesture they'll understand is...
My God!
You killed him.
How was I to know my fists would go right through his face? Still, it's made the others keep their distance. Uh-oh, get ready to duck. I think they're going to use their goads as spears. Oh, thank heavens, they were not meant for throwing. Quick, grab one.
I still haven't broken my chains. I don't have your strength.
Come here, I'll do it. Right, now, take a weapon.
No, I couldn't.
What?
Sorry.
This is no time to have scruples.
Well, there's a fair length of chain attached to my wrist. Perhaps if I was to flick it at them.
Oh, come on, then. We're going to have to charge through them to get back up the way we came. Ready?
Yes.
Now.
You've spoilt it all.
What on earth do you mean?
The violence. Completely the wrong thing.
Nonsense. It was that or death.
Yes, well, what are we to do now?
Try one of these side tunnels. We'll go somewhere along and hope they don't look up it too carefully. Now, We had better be silent for a while.
I can't hear anything.
Shh. Some luck at last. They've missed us. At least we'll have a breathing space in which to work out our next move.
I think our luck is even greater than that.
Why?
Up there, at the end of the tunnel. There's a sort of light, and it's not bluish like the stream.
A way out to the surface?
It's possible. Do we risk going on?
Of course we do. What is there to lose? With the glorious prospect of daylight as our goal, we clambered up a shaft which ran in a steep incline from the end of the tunnel. I eagerly led the way with my hopes of freedom leaping and bounding ahead of me. After a few minutes, the cleft opened out, and I hauled myself onto a small plateau. The sight I found there almost caused me to beat my head against the rocks in disappointment. Damn and blast!
What is it?
Our source of light. Luminous pink mushrooms. A whole little forest of the cursed things.
Oh, Lord. But how extraordinary.
Don't start extolling the scientific wonders of it.
As you wish. I would have sworn it was daylight all the same. Phosphorescence is usually green or blue.
How many more tricks has this place got in store for us?
What are you doing?
Booting as many of the blessed things as I can back down that hole. I suppose I may at least vent my frustration on the plant life.
Yes, if you wish, eventually, to put us back in the dark.
Plenty of them left.
Thank you very much.
How I long for real daylight. An English dawn over the Kent coast.
Our situation is all your fault.
My fault?
Our chances would have been better if you hadn't killed that Selenite.
I told you before there was no alternative. Cabba, I've just noticed. These chains, I'm certain of it. They're made of gold.
Oh, yes. Yes, they are.
The spear is too, if gold is their commonest metal.
Perhaps if we could hold out for a few days, news of our presence might filter down to the more intelligent Selenites.
This gold... If only we could get back to Earth and return with reinforcements, with guns.
That is a horrible notion.
More sensible than trying to impress idiots with Pythagoras' theorem.
When I came to the moon, I should have come alone.
But you didn't. Now, how are we going to get back to the sphere?
There's an air current here, which means the shaft is not a dead end. It might become very narrow further up, of course, but we
could
at least...
Quiet a moment. The Selenites. They're in the lower passage.
They might not think to look up here.
Perhaps. But they will. This time it really is my fault. They'll see the mushrooms I kicked down the shaft.
Then we must climb on and hope we don't get stuck.
We climbed perhaps a few hundred feet before getting to a grating. I was able to bend the grating bars enough for us to squeeze through. And once more, we were in a large cavern. At the far end, a group of Selenites was occupied in cutting up a dead moon calf. Near us was a pile of very large crowbars, like the ones the butchers were using to turn over the gigantic carcass. I exchanged my spear for one of these.
Can we not sneak through without their noticing us?
We'll try. They're pretty well distracted by their ghastly work.
That came from behind.
Yes, one of our hunters is squeezing his way out of the shaft.
Where are you going?
Back to discourage them. I swung at the first comer with my crowbar. One blow was enough to crumple him. Then, from behind his corpse, the point of a spear flashed out from the grating. I grabbed it, turned it around, and drove it back into its owner. The point had broken off, which seemed to make it inoffensive enough for Cavour to use. He had caught up with me and now stood guard by the shaft. In the meantime, the butchers had left their work and moved towards us, brandishing their little axes. They were short, thick little beggars with long arms. Grabbing a second crowbar, I made a charge which scattered them for a while.
Bedford!
What are you doing here? Look, they've started to come through the grating.
Oh, I'm sorry, but from back there I could see something going on beyond the carcasses. They've got what I think is a gun.
More like a crossbow. Come on, run.
You're hit.
So I've noticed.
We should surrender.
Surrender? Not a chance. The stinging wound had made me see scarlet. I was using my crowbars like a double scythe, and quite soon I was having to wade through a veritable mound of dead or writhing moon men.
Bedford!
What now?
Over there!
They've no weapons that can stop me.
It's not a weapon. I can see light. White light this time.
Another trick?
I don't think so.
All right. One more swipe at these devils.
Oh, for pity's sake, put an end to this bloodlust. I can see the moon's surface.
When it was quite clear that I had totally triumphed in the battle in the butcher's cavern, I hastened after Cavor. There was a slanting gallery which led to the moon's exterior, and we bounded up it like exiles heading for our native land. It was only when we had put a good distance between ourselves and the cavern entrance that I started to be aware of a change in the landscape.
There's hardly a touch of green left in these shrubs. In fact, all the plants seem to be dying in the heat.
It was bound to happen.
Well, we left them so fresh.
How long do you think we've been here?
Since escaping?
No, on the moon altogether.
I don't know. 2 earthly days, perhaps?
Well, you see, now, I would say it's more like 10.
10?
The sun is past its zenith and sinking in the west. In 4 earth days' time, or less, it will be night. A freezing lunar night.
But I still don't see how so much time can have gone by. And perhaps we were in that cell for a good deal longer than we realized. Even so, what about hunger? We've only eaten once since we arrived. Those damn mushrooms.
I know, but look, the stars prove I'm right.
Why should time seem different because we're on a smaller planet?
I don't know. There it is. It doesn't matter.
Lord, but it does. What do we think we're up to? 4 days left. We mustn't sit and dream. If we were to set fire to all this stuff, we might find the sphere amongst the ashes.
No. No more destruction.
All right. It seems as though the sun is going to do it for me all the same. Do you know, I suddenly feel our chances are good again.
Perhaps they are.
Why are you looking so downcast?
Wasted opportunity.
What was that?
Wasted opportunity. If we could have made it to the core and encountered the masters there, instead of fighting with no more than ignorant peasants. Oh, what I would have given to see the central ocean. Perhaps they have ships that go upon it. And all around, mighty cities which we will not see, ruled over by masters with a wisdom we will never come to know.
I've only spoilt it for you for the time being. We can return, better equipped, and meet these masters on our own terms.
Can we indeed? I almost dread taking my secret back to Earth. If it gets into the wrong hands, governments and powers will struggle to come here. They will fight against one another, and against these moon people. Someone will get my secret out of me in a very little while, and this planet will be strewn to its deepest galleries with dead humans and selenites. And to what end? Man has no use for the moon. What have they made of their own planet with a battleground of infinite folly? Science has toiled too long forging weapons for fools to use. And I hold the key to further disasters. And yet how can I keep the secret?
You kept it to yourself before.
Yes, but... Why should one worry? In spite of the dying plants, there's little hope of finding the sphere again.
Rubbish. It seems to me that you don't want to find it.
Perhaps. In my own case. But we must try, all the same. Let us search methodically and separately. I'll tie my handkerchief to this bush. It's a high enough spot to serve as a beacon. The one who finds the sphere will come back here and signal to the other.
And if neither of us find it?
We go on searching until the night and the cold overtake us.
Where's your weapon?
I threw it away.
You still have 2 crowbars. You had better take one.
No.
In that case, we'd better set off.
Yes. Au revoir.
Take care of yourself.
In a little while, it seemed to me as though I had always been alone on the moon. I hunted intently for a time, but the residual heat drained my energy, and without a companion to urge me on, I gave in to the need to rest. In fact, I slept. When I awoke, the sun was very low and the air much cooler. Remembering how quickly time passed on the moon, I feared that I might have lost yet another day, if not more. I made my way round in a semicircle, feeling increasingly oppressed by isolation and by the cold. I longed to find Cavor again and suggest that we get back inside the moon, whatever the risks. And then I saw the sphere. It lay further west and had signaled itself by reflecting the dying rays of the sun.
All in one piece, thank God.
Cavor! Cavor, here's the sphere!
Damn you, Why can't you see it too? It's too far to go back to the beacon.
Cavor!
I climbed inside, lay down my golden crowbars, and waited. I knew I ought to go back and signal, but something held me to the sphere. Time passed, and Cavor didn't arrive. Shaking off my reluctance, I went out again, shivering as I leapt away. Once I had reached the beacon, I scanned the world about me and saw nothing but empty terrain and, far away, the opening of the tunnel up which we had fled.
Cavor! Cavor! Cavor, please show yourself!
It was then that I saw, some 50 yards away, his cricket cap lodged in another bush. I leapt across, and close to where I landed, found a scrap of blood-stained paper hastily written on.
My kneecap is hurt, and I cannot run or leap or even crawl. They have been chasing me for some time. A different sort of Selenite altogether is in charge. Larger brain case, more slender body, and very short legs. His appearance gives me hope, for I have not been shot at. It seems they want to take me alive. That will give me a chance to...
Give you a chance to what? Oh, Cavor, you innocent. And now the snow starts. No. No, not yet. Wait. Wait.
With the tunnel closed, there was no chance of rescuing him. The final night of space was falling all around me as I tumbled into the sphere. I was a stupefied, half-dead being with icicles hanging from me.
The shutters. No, not yet. The manhole cover. Come on. Go tight, please. All right. Now, which button for the heater and light? I should remember. Here goes. Wrong. Wrong again. Very well. I might as well hit the lot of you.
And so I was back in space. My closing of all the shutters came more from desperation than skill. But I had a long, sad, and lonely journey home in which to learn control of the sphere. Even so, it was with a huge measure of luck that I eventually brought the vessel closer and closer to an expanse of sea. When the sphere hit the water, I flung all the shutters open and prayed that it would surface again like a true bubble. It did so. And my journey through space was over. After that, I slept, for I had landed at night, and when I awoke, the sphere was bobbing close by an earthly beach. When the manhole was loosed, the air hit me like a punch in the chest, and it was some minutes before I dropped into the shallows and waded ashore.
Hello yourself.
What on earth is that thing?
Can you tell me where I am?
Littleston. And that's Dungeness over there.
But almost exactly where we started from. Would even Cavor have expected that?
Have you floated ashore? Have you been wrecked or something?
I want help.
Oh, rather. Anything for a fellow Englishman in trouble.
In that sphere, there are two big bars of gold.
Oh, yes.
I'm exhausted. If you could see your way to fetching them out for me, I'd be most grateful. I don't want to risk leaving them there, you see.
Oh, come on, Desmond. Let's see if he's pulling our legs. Rum sort of lifeboat.
My own design.
Ah. Well, you're right about this stuff, you know. It is gold. And each bar's at least 6 foot long. Mm-hmm. Where did you get it?
On the moon.
Oh, I see. Intrepid explorer type, eh?
I think he's taken a long voyage back from fighting the Boers.
You're wrong. I've never been to the Cape Colony or any of those places.
If you say so.
Say,
what the devil? Was it a thunderbolt?
Well, whatever it was, it's put paid to his lifecraft. No sight of it, old chap, even though it was in the shallows. I say.
Oh, poor fellow, stunned.
My heart was near breaking as I wondered who had pressed the studs which closed all the shutters. Was it a child who had sneaked from the beach when no one was looking? I resolved, on any account, to keep doggedly quiet. After all, nothing I could do would bring back the child, or the sphere. It was the final disaster. My intention of going back to the moon, of getting a sphere full of gold, of eventually getting Cavorite analyzed to release its secret, perhaps even of recovering Cavor's body, all these ideas vanished altogether. I am the sole survivor, and that is about all. Amidst the shadows of vine leaves, under the blue sky of southern Italy, I have recorded these events, which few will believe actually happened. Indeed, there are moments when, in spite of my moon gold, I more than half believe myself that the whole thing was a dream. Thus, I concluded my narrative, I wrote the end, made a flourish, and threw aside my pen. By the time the extracts had appeared in the Strand magazine, I had moved on from Italy to Algiers. There, a letter was forwarded to me, an astonishing communication, from a Mr. Julius Vendiche.
Dear Mr. Bedford, forgive me for writing to you when we are unacquainted. Forgive me also for my not always precise English. I am a Dutchman. However, I feel you are interested in what I am going to say. 3 years ago, in 1898, I built for myself an observatory on Monte Rosa in the pass of San Gotthard. There I have experimented in receiving electrical messages from outer space. In particular, I did hope to hear messages from Mars, as did the esteemed Professor Tesla in America. So far, fortune has failed me there. Instead, I received transmissions from the moon. Tesla's messages from Mars were incomprehensible. Mine were, obviously from the start, in Morse code. When I had decoded them, they proved to come from your former companion, Mr. Cavor. If it was possible, I wish to invite you to visit me, for the messages continue and are extraordinary. I remain, sir, your obedient servant, Julius Vendiche, Bachelor of Science.
It's in your bed, but Professor...
At last! Come in, Mr. Bedford. If only you had been here some moments sooner.
Another message?
Yes, but there will be nothing more today. Mr. Cavor indicated that he was halting transmission. A greatly fragmented bulletin, but I will show you it and the others later. First, you need a rest after traveling. Some refreshment, perhaps.
I would rather look at the transcripts first.
Of course.
I am amazed that those primitives should have such a thing as a radio transmitter, let alone that they should permit Cavor to use it.
I think you will be surprised about these moon men when you come to the later details. The first messages concern the making of the space vehicle and your journey.
He gives the formula for Cavorite.
Alas, no.
Oh.
But perhaps in time.
He'd better. It's our only chance of getting him back.
If that is his desire.
Of course it is. Or it will be once he's learned his fill of life up there. I know the man. We were very close.
Ah.
You look skeptical.
You had better read.
Some of this is desperately unfair to me, you know. To say that once on the moon I became impulsive, rash and quarrelsome, and to blame my intoxication for getting us captured.
Well, I was not there, so...
And this, mistaking certain gestures of theirs, he gave way to panic violence... I still bear the scars of those certain gestures.
It all sounds very unfortunate, but at least they did not kill Mr. Cavor when he gave himself up.
He did not give himself up. He was bloodily captured.
It is all a great pity.
And to say I probably found the sphere and made off with it to steal a march on him. Steal a march? I very nearly froze to death searching for him.
Undoubtedly he was wrong to say that.
As wrong as was his notion that thereafter I would find the craft uncontrollable and perish in outer space.
The light of that sits angrily before you in your own observatory.
Oh, I am sorry these details have upset you so, but I could not hide them from you.
No, I realize that. I'm not blaming you.
At least, in the rest, you are not mentioned at all.
I'm not. It's probably as well. I think I shall accept your offer of refreshment before I read on.
After supper, I retired to Vendighe's guest room and read the rest of the transcripts before falling asleep. The following morning found us back amidst his electrical equipment in case a message should come.
You are looking much happier now, Mr. Bedford.
Oh, yes. Once Cavour gets away from slandering me, it's capital stuff. So, they transported him down through the shafts in a sort of balloon, and they took him to see the great central sea. That was one of his main obsessions.
And this Fayoux, who has learnt Earth speech at such a speed, seems a kindly and intelligent creature.
That gives a warning of a possible message. I shall try and decode immediately for you as it comes through.
Thank you.
My friend and guide, Fayoux, tells me I am to be taken into the presence of the Grand Luna.
The receiver may have picked up dots and dashes, but once again I was hearing the voice of this muddled genius. I felt I could even see or hear what he described.
The Grand Luna is total master of the moon. But before I am given my audience, I must clearly understand the order of existence here, so that I may appreciate his greatness. Fayoux tells me that in the moon, every citizen knows his place. He is born to that place, and the training, education, and surgery he undergoes fits him at last so completely to it that he has neither ideas nor organs for any purpose beyond it. Am I right, Fayoux, in thinking that is why the cleverest of your people need to be carried from place to place, or like we are?
Yes. Only brain grows feet. Limbs and bodies stay small.
Does this not anger those who have to carry them?
No. They only know carrying. This is store of knowledge.
My God, what are these creatures?
This row of brains not move and work. Others come and ask questions when you need to.
It was a sort of living library, for these moon people do not have such things as books. A fascinating but somewhat chilling sight, this line of vast but immobile heads, crammed with facts, but apparently incapable of logical thought. The next chamber was filled with jars, from which only the arms of the occupants protruded. Do they not feel pain being crushed inside those containers?
Yes, but only at beginning.
You mean they get used to it?
Used to it means no pain.
I wonder. And what do they do?
Work machines.
So they are almost like part of the machine.
That is their purpose.
For a while, I could not lose the fit of melancholy brought on by the sight of these wretched hand tentacles sticking out of their jars. Though, of course, it is really, in the end, a far more humane proceeding than our earthly method of leaving children to grow into human beings and then making machines of them. But now I must stop, for I am very soon due to encounter
the Lord of all these wonders.
You see, the moon has unhinged his rational powers. Deep down, he realizes they're a cruel race, but he stubbornly goes on proclaiming how enlightened he finds them. What rubbish he talks about earthly cruelty. It's certainly not like that in England.
Perhaps this Fayoux has learnt Morse as well, and Mr. Cavour has to be careful what messages he sends out.
Cavour being politic? Possibly. Well, he was suffering from moon madness before I took leave of him. And now we have to wait and see how he gets on with their big chief. But how long? Oh,
several hours at least, I would have thought.
Vendighe and I did not stray far from the observatory. We waited and waited and waited. I was beginning to fear for his safety when there was a sudden burst of static and the Morse stuttered forth.
Fayoux and I were born majestically
on litters through the greatest throng.
There were trumpeters and a company of attendants bearing and dragging banners and masses of scented fungus and curious symbols. We passed through a series of halls, each one more wondrously vaulted than the last. A thin haze of phosphorescent blue made all around me seem intangible. In the midst of this splendour, I felt extremely shabby and unworthy. Finally, we entered the largest hall of all. A flight of steps ascended almost out of sight at the end. And there at the summit, the Grand Lunar exulted on his throne. A radiating glow surrounded his brain case, which must have measured many yards in diameter. And with a start, I noticed no face as such, but two minute elfin eyes peering out. Below, I distinguished his little dwarfed body and its insect-jointed limbs, shriveled and white. He was scrutinizing the first man to go before him, and I could not but experience an icy jab of fear. And I would like to... Well, I...
He says we feel great wonder at your planet, that he understands men live on the surface, not beneath.
That is...
Continue.
Oh, may I? Thank you. That is true, Your Majesty. Thus, a sort of dialogue began. At first, he was obsessively interested in the physical geography of our planet, and then in the biological condition of man and all other living creatures. Eventually, we arrived at social and political matters, where I have to admit my knowledge was less sound, though I did my best.
The Grand Luna is greatly worried by this, what you call, democracy.
Democracy?
Yes. He asks, is there no Grand Earthly?
A Grand Earthly? Oh, certainly not. Some men have thought they could be. But in the end, they've always been put in their place. What's happening?
They spray Grand Luna with water to cool his brain.
Good Lord, because of what I said? Quite frankly, I should think never. When his brain had been cooled for a second time, the Grand Lunar interrogated me very closely upon the secret of my spacecraft. In a little while, I was allowed to put questions of my own to him, and at last I realized why, in spite of the vastness of their science, they had never discovered a substance like cavorite. It seems they know of it in theory, but to create it is an impossibility.
Because there is no helium on the moon, and helium...
Oh, no, this damn machine!
It is not my equipment. Atmospheric incursions.
Quickly, what does he say?
Cavorite, made as follows. Take...
Take what?
Euless? I do not know this English word, Euless.
It isn't English. Perhaps he was trying to say it's useless. Come on, Cavour, come on.
That is it.
For heaven's sake, is there no way you can send a message out asking what's going on?
I am still in the process of developing a strong enough transmitter.
How long before it's ready?
I do not know. Months, a year maybe.
I can't wait until then.
The progress of science can rarely be forced.
What progress? We're stuck down here while poor old Cavour is... Oh, Lord, I can see it as if I was there. He's struggling with those damned insect men, perhaps even fighting at last. They may have killed him. They'll have to, because he finally realized what they were like.
Oh, because they now know what we are like. Your friend was very candid and open in what he told the Grand Lunar about life on Earth.
But Cavour hardly knows anything about life on Earth. He should have kept his mouth shut. Vendiche, are you sure that receiver of yours is switched on?
Oh, yes, it is switched on, but I fear there is nothing more to receive.
Even so, we sat for hours waiting in that little observatory, trying to ignore the obvious truth that Cavour had been forced into the unknown, into the dark, into the silence that has no end.
In The First Men in the Moon by H.G. Wells, dramatized for radio by Terry James, Hal Bennett played Bedford and William Rushton Cavill. Vendiche was played by David March, Fayou by Paul Rosebery, The Grand Lunar by Stephen Garlick, Spargus by Malcolm Gerrard, Quaid by David McAllister, and The Two Men on the Beach by David Bradshaw and Hayden Wood. The First Men in the Moon was directed by Glyn Dearman.